Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
On today's episode of Mentally Stronger.
2 years later in 2019, I was on vacation with my mom, who is much closer to, with my three kids and my dog, and she died suddenly in her sleep. And that experience was the complete opposite. So if my dad's was like sipping little cups of grief, my mother's was like being kidnapped, then waterboarded by grief. And almost immediately, the first thing I thought when I understood that my mother had died was that it was my fault. Like, I saw that almost like a sentence in my vision, like, it is your fault. And that it was like, I don't know, it was like a little bulldog that like clamped its teeth onto me and it wouldn't let go. And it didn't let me go. And I knew that it was bigger and more powerful than my capacity to defend against it. So I ended up checking myself into the same inpatient facility that I send my clients when, you know, the work in the room is not enough, which was pretty terrifying and humbling. And then I came out the other side with a really embodied understanding of what being a griever is, sort of differently than me.
Welcome to Mentally Stronger, the show that will help you develop the mental strength you need to reach your greatest potential, no matter what life throws your way. I'm Amy Morin, psychotherapist, mental strength trainer, and an international best-selling author of 6 books on mental strength. Every Monday, I introduce you to a guest whose story and expertise can inspire you to think, feel, and do your best in life. And the fun part is, we record it all from a sailboat in the Florida Keys. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Do you know how to grieve? If you're like most people, the answer is no. No one teaches us how to heal from heartbreak and how to cope with loss. And we should be talking about those things because all of us are going to experience grief at various points in our lives. That's why I wanted to get Megan Jarvis on the show. She's a therapist who lost both of her parents in a short period of time. And she realized that the resources we have for grief are limited. So she set out on a journey to give people real tools that will help them work through their grief in a productive way. Megan wrote a book about her experience called End of the Hour. She's also the host of a podcast called Grief is My Side Hustle. Some of the things she shares are steps you can take to heal after a loss, how to know when to get professional help, and what to avoid so you don't make things worse. So here's Megan Jarvis on how to heal when you're grieving. Megan Jarvis, welcome to Mentally Stronger.
I am so delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So you and I connected on Threads, a couple months ago. I learned you had a podcast called Grief is My Side Hustle. So I immediately reached out and said, that is the most amazing name of a podcast ever. I learned you were also a therapist. You'd also written a book. So I thought, we clearly have many things in common. You let me be a guest on your show, which was so fun. I knew that you had to come be a guest on Mentally Stronger. So thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been such a fan of yours. That's how it opened up in Threads is... you were saying something and I had to come in behind you and be like, and Amy knows what she's talking about and she has a million books and she's being very modest. So you are my first Threads connection. I regularly stalk people on Instagram, but I'm kind of new to Threads and look what it already brought me.
Right. So good things do come out of social media sometimes.
We are here. We are the testimony of that truth.
So I guess, like myself, you were a therapist whose experiences, though, your life experiences are what's really changed a lot for you, led to this book, led to this podcast. Do you want to tell our audience a little bit about your story and how it came to be?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if you had met me 5 or 6 years ago, what you would have heard was that, you know, I kind of always described myself as a helper, that I had had a really significant loss in my childhood that I did not come to understand was significant until I was in my 20s. When I was 9, a person who was sort of like considered a cousin to my family drowned while I was on the beach, and everyone, you know, that in this small town was sort of there, but he was 16. And you don't pay attention to 16-year-olds when they're swimming. So this terrible tragedy and accident happened that really impacted my family and impacted the town that I grew up in. And that was a summer town on Cape Cod. And then we pivoted into the fall and back into another community that I lived where no one knew that this terrible thing had happened. So almost, you know, accidentally, it went from being the most important, most significant thing in every single day of my life to no one ever talking about it, and almost as though it didn't happen. And I didn't really come to understand that that really left an imprint on me in a significant way in terms of like how I attach to people and my general outlook in the world. I sort of thought everybody was a little bit afraid that their older brothers were going to die until I went through a breakup. And I went through this breakup and sort of could see that, like, you know, that gaze that you get where you're talking about something that you are deeply passionate about, like your broken heart, and you can see the person's eyes kind of like they have lost interest in what you're saying.
Yes.
That started to happen. And I was like, oh, man, these are new friends that I have just made in my new young 20 life. I don't want to ruin it. So I went to a therapist, and that therapist said, sort of heard what it was like for me to be going through this breakup, which was really terrifying and incredibly hard. And she said, what bad thing happened to you in your childhood? And I just thought, like, is this lady even listening? I'm not talking about my childhood. And I said nothing. I said, I don't think anything bad happened. And then, of course, I came back the second session and was like, well, wait, this probably isn't relevant at all, but this thing happened and then we never talked about it again. And she was like, yeah, that's probably relevant. So I came into my career, let's say, as a therapist with that personal background, really thrilled by the therapy work that I learned to do in my early 20s that allowed me to, what I really felt at the time was kind of heal a lot of those old wounds and move forward. And so I had a private practice in DC where I saw a lot of complicated trauma cases. I'm trained in somatic therapies and EMDR, the things that sort of move energy through the body. And, you know, good day job. I have kids. It was like a nice amount of good work. And I felt very called to my work. And then in 2016, my dad was diagnosed with small cell cancer. And small cell cancer is a death sentence. So I understood that he was dying pretty much from the minute he got his diagnosis. Other members of my family were not quite as aware of that. So we had this odd kind of dance inside the family that was like, I have 5 brothers and sisters, but it was a very lonely period for me because there wasn't a shared understanding of what was happening to him. And so I ended up having to sort of call an oncologist friend and be like, this is what's happening, right? And he'd be like, yeah, no, he's still dying, regardless of what treatments he's trying. Or so knowing that my dad was gravely ill, even though we weren't super close, I ended up kind of, the way that I talk about it is like choosing to sip cups of grief. I flew to where he was, which was alternately in a hospital and then sort of like a rehab facility that was acting as a hospice in Massachusetts. And I just spent time with him, which is not really something I had ever done in my entire adult life, like deliberately make a trip to hang out with my dad. But the way I describe it is like I participated in his death. He knew he was dying. I knew he was dying. We had these really important phone call, important meetings where like, I imported all his contacts into my phone. Mm-hmm. And then we went through each one of his contacts. There were many people he wanted to be contacted personally, to be told personally when he died. We get to talk about that stuff. 2 years later in 2019, I was on vacation with my mom, who I was much closer to, with my three kids and my dog, and she died suddenly in her sleep. And that experience was the complete opposite. So if my dad's was like sipping little cups of grief, my mother's was like being kidnapped, then waterboarded by grief. And ultimately what happened, and it had this very meta component to it, because I treat very complicated cases where people have had unresolved grief from their childhood and then a new grief, and they're kind of mixed together, or they have very symptomatic grief. You know, they're physically really dysregulated in their bodies. So I've been treating those kinds of cases. So almost immediately, the first thing I thought when I understood that my mother had died was that it was my fault. Like, I saw that almost like a sentence in my vision, like, it is your fault. Because I had had some awareness that she was sick, as had she, although no one thought she was gravely sick. And that it was like, I don't know, it was like a little bulldog that like clamped its teeth onto me and it wouldn't let go. And then it became something that clinically we would call a rumination, where my mind just like walked around this track with holding on to that idea, like, it is your fault. And it didn't let me go. And I knew that it was bigger and more powerful than my capacity to defend against it. So I ended up checking myself into the same inpatient facility that I send my clients when, you know, the work in the room is not enough, which was pretty terrifying and humbling. And again, sort of gave me a totally different insight into what my clients had been doing for all of these years. You know, you can't necessarily know a road until you walk it yourself. And then I came out the other side with a really embodied understanding of what being a griever is, sort of differently than maybe the way that I had been understanding it, either from a childhood perspective or clinically for, you know, 20 years.
Thank you for sharing all of that with me. And for acknowledging too that as therapists, we know information, we teach it to other people. But when you're going through it, the emotions cloud everything and you just can't see certain things. You can't see it from a different perspective. And it's so hard to even figure out which way is up and which way is down sometimes, despite having the knowledge, the textbook knowledge, the information, and being able to teach it to other people. But that's difficult for a lot of us to acknowledge too. So thank you for doing that as well.
Well, you know, it's funny because people often say to me, I have advanced degrees, you know, the kind where like it takes 5 years to get certified and stuff. So these aren't weekend workshops and master's degrees. So I've read lots of books, and I wanted more than anything that particular kind of education to be like a raft or a life preserver around the rest of grief for the rest of my life. Although I don't think I was totally conscious of that. But when my mother died, I was like, oh no, I'm about to learn that that's not how it works. And in fact, all the education that I had, really the core of what it helped me with was understanding that I did not, pretty much from the minute I started to have grief symptoms, that they were going to need treatment. They were not the kind that we consider sort of typical disruptive, but with enough support, kind of abate on their own. Like from the beginning, I was like, oh, this is a clinical case. This needs help and support. So I didn't do what some of my clients do, which is wait a year before they seek out treatment. I was scrambling, you know, within a couple of months, understanding that I'm not going to be able to manage this by myself. That was the advantage of all my education, was like having a deep understanding of, oh, I am really screwed. This is not a small thing that I've got myself into.
What are those signs for somebody listening who says, gosh, is this something I can manage on my own? If I've lost somebody, yes, I'm sad and I'm grieving, but how do you know when you need professional treatment? And then how do you know when you need more than just, say, 1 hour of therapy a week?
Oh, so good. So, I mean, I don't need to tell you this, but I'll tell it to the audience, that trauma in general is not, we don't have a core definition for trauma other than it's a bad thing that happens. And what makes trauma traumatizing is the meaning that is made inside your system. So there's a whole bunch of folks out there who, yeah, we all live through COVID, which is a trauma, collective trauma. But for some people, those were the best couple of years of their lives. And for others, it left an imprint or kind of tattoo of all the good things now are a little bit worse. So one thing that I think is kind of important is to think about, you know, grief is not even like a mental health problem. It's just a developmental thing that we all experience, and that grief is the reaction to loss. So whatever your loss is, it doesn't have to be the death of a parent. It could be you didn't get a job or that you got divorced. Anything that we lose, there's going to be some grief. But grief should move. It should shift. It should be a thing that comes and goes and flows in and out of you. And that the symptoms that you have with grief, so we have, again, you know this, but there are 12 physical systems in the body that are interrelated. And it's funny, my daughter who's 16, she's just learning these things. She was like, Mom, they were talking about this in my science class. So, you know, your digestion and your reproduction and your vascular system. And so all of those systems, we have 12 of them, are impacted by trauma, and they're impacted in specific ways. So, you know, your digestion could be that you're hungry all the time, more than you would normally be, or you can't really eat at all. Your ability to fall asleep, stay asleep, can be impacted because of your endocrine system and your hormones being impacted. So what we're looking at is, what are the physical symptoms in the body that have been driven by this new energy that is created in the grief? And so for me, I was not sleeping. I was not eating. Now, when your central nervous system begins to sort of integrate, when your brain begins to integrate, it begins to learn the reality, right? I have kids, and I always use this example that, like, when my kids went to preschool for the first day of preschool, the amount of learning they did in that 3 hours, you have to line up, you have to ask permission, the blocks go in the orange container. They came home after those 3 hours, like a guy who had worked in the mines,
right?
Like, had to eat a snack and then conked out in front of the TV. And then the next day they kind of didn't want to go. Grief is like that. It's like my entire experience on the planet, I had a mom who was there who I could call. And now suddenly, 45 years of that, I have to learn how to be on the planet without that backstop and that sort of lighthouse that I had always had. So when the symptoms come, which are a reaction to the loss, that's not a problem. What I consider to be the problem is when those symptoms get much worse rapidly than better. And I don't mean like, oh, you had a bad day versus a good day. They ebb and flow. But for me, that rumination that I locked into, that went from being something I thought about once or twice a day to any time there wasn't a different distracting thought in my mind. And so you can go to the clinical books. There are some diagnoses out there. I'm not even going to say them out loud because I don't like them. You can go to the clinical books, and the clinical books are going to say, if you have these symptoms for 6 weeks or over a year or this, you know, are you yearning? Are you? I don't find that very helpful. What I find really helpful is, are your symptoms disrupting your life? Is it worse? And grief symptoms, again, are going to be physical symptoms that are inside your body, as well as all that yearning and sadness. And is it making it difficult for you to do the job of grieving, right? It's really hard to grieve and learn how to carry the loss of someone if you can't sleep at all, or if you can't eat at all. So that's a long answer to the short question, but if I were going to put it in a sentence, if you feel like you are getting worse over time and that the grief is harder, go to a clinician. We would never say, you know, if you said to me like, oh, my elbow hurts a little bit, I would say, Amy, have you been to the doctor? And you wouldn't be like, oh, I don't think I should go to the doctor until it's hurt for like a year. I think I should wait.
Right.
You would be like, yeah, no, I should probably go to a doctor. That's what I say about the symptoms. If you think, I wonder if it's supposed to be this bad, go talk to a doctor and let them say, And that doctor being a trauma-informed therapist, somebody who specializes in grief and loss. And trauma-informed is going to look like people who do somatic trainings, also EMDR, IFS, sensory motor psychotherapy, all that kind of stuff.
And you know, it's interesting. So many people, when they talk about grief, they don't even talk about the physical symptoms of it. They just say, you know, you're sad, you miss somebody. And the advice, the typical advice is make sure you're eating a healthy diet.
Yeah.
Get plenty of sleep. Take care of yourself. And when you are in the thick of it,
it's impossible to do those things.
Can't do that.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, and like, what do people do when somebody dies? They bring you food. And when you can't eat and it's just all this food piled up and you think, well, you know, I literally don't have an appetite. And, and it feels like every little thing, because I remember people would tell me, make sure you get plenty of exercise, make sure you do this. And it just feels impossible.
It does feel impossible. And yet also those are good pieces of advice.
Yes. Let's pause for a second right here while I share some special offers from our sponsors. Do you want to get high quality meat delivered straight to your house? Or in my case, a sailboat? Try ButcherBox. It saves me time and money. And if you order right now, Mentally Stronger listeners can get steak, chicken, or salmon free in every single order for an entire year. I love that ButcherBox offers grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, and wild-caught seafood. There are no antibiotics or added hormones. They even offer vegetarian options. ButcherBox lets you decide how often you want deliveries, and you can pick a curated plan, or you could completely customize your box. Sign up at butcherbox.com/stronger and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer, plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/stronger and use code STRONGER to choose your free for a year offer. Plus get $20 off your first order. This is the first time in my life when I haven't had a pet. Up until 2 years ago, I had Jackson, a 19-year-old Himalayan cat, and Fiona, a 17-year-old English Springer Spaniel. Both of them lived on the sailboat and adjusted pretty well to life on the water. I miss them, and I look forward to getting another pet when the time is right. Today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Your pet is part of the family, and you want the best for them no matter what. But vet bills can really add up. That's why you should check out pet insurance. And with ASPCA Pet Health Insurance, you can focus on the care your pet deserves and cover what matters most. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/stronger. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/stronger. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/stronger. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency, LIM.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Okay, we're back.
So I have a model that I use with my clients and my corporate clients, which is, it's called the grief mentor method, which the idea behind it is that you become your own expert and mentor yourself through the grief process. And it mentor stands for six different things. I can tell you what they are, but the idea being, here's what we know that grievers have reported are important and significant, like pillars that they lean on in order to get through the process. And so what we do now, let me just go back. I would encourage the audience, if you were interested in becoming a vegan, you would go to Google and say, how do I become a vegan? And there's probably 70 really reliable results that will come up. Doctors, you know, NIH, all kinds of stuff, as well as like Steve becomes a vegan. Like everything is there. If you wanted to run a marathon, same story. Try Googling, how do I grieve my grandmother? Because here's what comes up. The first is like an odd derivative of Wikipedia. The second is Quora. And the third is Reddit. These are not reliable sources on how to engage with the grief process. That's how poorly educated we are. So I built this model, which is the grief mentor method, just to give people my 20 years of experience around what it takes to learn to carry your loss. So M stands for mindfulness. We start with mindfulness because you need to go into the body to find the energy in order to attend to yourself. So often people stop in the mindfulness for months because just being inside their body is hard. Just encouraging the energy to like look inside is hard. And the energy that they have is mostly exhaustion. And so we're not going any further. We're just going to tend to the exhaustion by maybe adding some exercise or maybe adding some rest. The E stands for energy. So what kind of energy do you have? For some people, when they experience a loss, they experience it as borderline panic and really high anxiety, which comes from those fight, flight, and freeze responses. When you are in a high energy state, we meet that kind of like a yin and yang. We probably come and meet it at a high energy state, and then we try to bring it down. Try to bring your whole threshold down. And so we have some exercises that we do that with. And there's also a whole host of people who they look more depressed. They can't get out of bed. They, you know, don't want to do anything. They're not anxious. They're just sort of checked out. So we attend to that energy differently. We ask those people maybe to have a friend come and take a walk with them. And then energy also means, are you going inward or outward with it, right? And energy that goes inward, like I had, which was, this is my fault, kind of drives depression. And energy that goes outward, you're going to see that as somebody just pissed off at everyone in the world. But it's important to know which way your energy is going because we need to kind of balance it. N stands for nourishment. How do you get nourished? And so that is the food, right? Because we need the macronutrients in order to create serotonin inside our gut so that it will send the signals that it's okay to rest and restore and let the body carry the weight of the loss. But also nourishment is listening to music. It's talking to friends. It's a spiritual practice. It's an understanding of whether or not you like signs or you believe in something that's a larger structure. And then T is about translating. So what is the story that you believe, right? You and I, when you were on my podcast, you told me back-to-back multiple losses. Those are really hard to carry. And sometimes people will come out of that feeling very victimed and helpless and hopeless. So first we take a look at the story. What happened to you? And creating a narrative that you can live with. And then how do I communicate that to others so that they understand what my needs are? So if my story is my mother died suddenly when I was on vacation with her and my kids, if that's my story, then how do I translate that to others? Well, then I might need to add some. And I had to check myself into an inpatient facility and take 6 months off of work. Okay, now we kind of understand what Megan is dealing with. So that translation and also being able to talk it out. We do a lot of journaling in this section. This section is really about being able to let people sort of move the words through them and understand themselves in words. And then O stands for outside. So first, that's getting outside before noon so that you can get some sun, vitamin D into your system again to sort of help generate serotonin, which is really important in the process of grieving and I think healing in general. But also outside, thinking outside of your current network, because, and you and I talked a little bit about this, all the relationships get a little wonky when you go through a profound loss because you're not the same. And the people around you not everybody is able to engage with loss. And so sometimes you have this secondary pain of people that you thought you were deeply close to not being able to show up. And when that happens, what we have to be able to do is find and bring in new people so that our net doesn't end up with holes in it. And then the last one is about ritual and rest, that we create rituals. One of the questions I get asked a lot is sort of like, how do I honor the birthday or the anniversary? Or, and here's the thing, I don't know how you should honor the birthday, but if you move through the grief mentor method, you have an idea of what works for you. For some people, they're going to spend most of their time bulking up their spiritual practice. For other people, they're going to learn that like exercise or using music or being creative is really a tool for them. When you figure out which of the pillars or which of the many pillars helps you, by the time you get to ritual, you have a better sense. I want to have a concert. I want to create a foundation. Like you get a sense of what it is. And then after ritual, we also have rest. For some people in grief, they feel like they're being chased and they feel like they need to run. And so being able to find and bring into the system some level of stillness so that, again, you can integrate reality, which is you are living with this loss, that's a practice that we also encourage people to do. So this is the grief mentor method is something that people can use every day as just a structure. And I have, you know, I'm working with a client right now who lost a loved one very recently. And I just ask her about the structure. Mm-hmm. I say, did you get outside? And she says, no. And I say, that's great. That's fine. I'm just asking her about it to remind her that being outside is important. So for some people, just looking at the structure and being like, all right, maybe tomorrow I'm going to try to do a little bit of X and Y and Z, helps them understand, answer that question of what do we do to grieve?
And I think that is an amazing roadmap of giving people those ideas of what do you do to try to work through the pain that you're experiencing, yeah, because it feels so immobilizing. And I don't know about you, but I have a lot of people who have read about the stages of grief,
yeah,
and they come in and they want to know like, what stage am I in? And am I almost done?
Yeah.
And they're really like, just like white knuckling it, hoping that any moment now they're going to feel better. But for a lot of people, they've just waited. Like they, yeah, believe that idea that time heals, and they've waited and they just haven't really worked through the pain yet. They've spent a lot of time successfully avoiding it,
yeah,
and trying to work around it. And because of that, so I love this idea you gave people. We'll make sure that everybody in our show notes can find it. I suspect you have a link somewhere where we can send
you.
People.
It's still being built out. So just come to my website for it, because it's not a book yet. And it's probably going to be a video series that people can access first.
We will link to that so that people can make sure that they have a resource, because it's a common question I get from our listeners is, but how do you deal with grief? And I don't think there are a lot of resources for people, as you discovered since you created this podcast.
I mean, we kind of leave people to invent it. Like if I said, listen, I need you to make a casserole, like there are so much advice, and so many ideas about that. And what we mostly hear around grief and loss is like, well, you can't teach it. And the thing is, we can. You can teach it the way you teach a puberty class or a pregnancy class or a class on aging. If you focus on we grieve with our bodies because we do, and focus on just, we're going to personalize it the same way you would an exercise class or learning how to sing. Not everybody is going to do that the same, but that doesn't mean we don't have some wisdom. And the hard thing about the stages of grief is that they are not stages of grief, really. And I think most of us in the grief field would, if we had one wish, it would be to just take that whole aspect. That's a little bit like saying the world is flat. We've known for a long time the world is not flat. We don't need to say that anymore. The stages of grief were really designed, I know you know this, to support people who were dying. And because there was a dearth of support for people who were grieving, we just kind of pulled it over into that space. But that's never what it was designed for. And then instead what we have are grief theories, which there are a couple that are useful, intellectually useful, but they still don't help you with what you're supposed to do. And the reality about being a griever is that You were walking on a path. It was the path you expected to be on. There was a hurricane or a flood, and that path got swept out. You spend some time going, crap, where's the path? And you're sick with that. You do have to sort of acknowledge and integrate, like, no more path. But at some point, you do have to move forward, bushwhacking your own path. And that actually, that novelty is really when we're moving through grief, when we're learning to integrate grief, when we're learning to carry it. And if we don't give somebody a structure about how you do that, how would they know how to do it? How would they know? I mean, my well-meaning friend is going to tell me how she did it, but I'm not like her. So then that doesn't help enough. And this tool is really based on like what everybody has been saying for a long time, but maybe rubs up against the idea that we can't teach grief because it's so personal. I mean, to me, that's so absurd. Like, so is sex, but we teach classes on sex.
Right, right.
There are books on sex. There's no reason why we can't. I think we're just really avoidant about it in general.
Right, because we're uncomfortable talking about it. We'd all like to not have to discuss this subject. And even as a therapist, and I shared this on your show, like I knew grief affects your body and you have physical symptoms and those sorts of things. But when my husband passed away, it was 20 below out and I was outside in a t-shirt and for the whole week, and people would be like, you know, of course, horrified and race to get me a jacket. And I can remember saying, like, turning to my sister, who happens to be a therapist as well. And I said, I don't feel cold.
Yeah.
It was the strangest thing, but I can remember it like being like, this is weird. And I should, and even though, and had I not been a therapist, I don't know how I would have gotten through that period of my life, because I think I would have thought I had lost touch with everything and would have just wondered like, what is this? Or have
people feel crazy. That's what happens. Yes. That, I mean, that's sort of a derogatory word, but that is the word that people use with me. Like, I think I'm going crazy because they have impacts in their memory. They're not inside their body in the same way. And again, we can sort of touch the neuroscience and the bioscience. There's a reason why your body didn't feel cold, because all the blood was rushing to your torso because you were in a really hyperactive state of reactivity where your body was trying to save your own life, because the trauma of losing your husband was that significant that your arms didn't feel cold because they probably didn't have the regular amount of blood flow.
Right.
Right. So like, we can teach this. I don't know if the griever in the moment is going to really care about that. But again, being able to say to somebody, you are not crazy. Your body is doing the best it can. It's doing weird stuff, but this is what it takes to sort of survive something this fundamentally dysregulating.
And your brain plays tricks on you too, right? The
sure
amount
does.
Of thoughts you have that are just not you or the, and for so many of them, you know, for instance, I would find something of my husband's and I, for a long time, it would be like, oh, I have to tell him about this, or, oh, his shirt's in the laundry, so I have to get that clean for Monday. Yeah. And it takes a really long time for your brain to get to that point of realizing this is final.
That's right.
And the book, The Year of Magical Thinking, I can remember somebody said to me, read that book, but don't read it right now. And that was good advice.
Right.
In that early days of grief, that book wouldn't have been helpful, but it's about a mom who was grieving and the strange things that were going on with her. And I did find that book helpful, but can you talk a little bit about the strange thoughts we have and how
totally.
It really affects
our
thinking?
Totally. Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Yeah. I mean, I always say this, and I think I said it in my book. I threw my American Express card away like 7 times after my mom died, so many times that I can't get an American Express card anymore because I think they thought I was like selling copies of it on the black market. So what happens? Well, there's a couple of things that happened, but I'll tell you the neuroscience first. So we have these two, they're like paired, almond-shaped parts of the way down in our brain called the amygdala, which people may have heard of. What they do is they swell in size, they enlarge when there is a sense of threat. So it doesn't distinguish whether that threat is a bear or a guy with a gun or someone who died or a storm or just something that you are intellectually afraid of. It just activates that alarm system. And when it does that, it's way at the bottom of your brain. Our critical thinking is behind our forehead. So that's miles of road to get from the bottom of your brain by your neck up to your critical thinking and the prefrontal cortex. If you think about it, like the amygdala enlarged and it's a little bit like a bouncer not letting other things into the club. So the electrical currents that would otherwise stimulate your critical thinking, your memory, all the parts of your brain that regulate like your digestion and your ability to eat and sleep, all of that is cut off. So the mailman can't get through to put the little messages into the mailboxes in an appropriate way. He's kind of just throwing the mail. So we get really poor messaging. And then we have one cranial nerve. Our 10th cranial nerve is the vagus nerve. So most of our, we have 12 total. So the other 11 go from the brain down into the body. And one, the vagus nerve, goes from the brain down into the body and then the body back up into the brain. So if you think the amygdala enlarge, activate this alarm system, send very poor messages up into the brain. Those messages travel down the vagus nerve into the body and do things like forget to tell you to be hungry or make you be much more hungry or give you diarrhea or make your heart race or, you know, make your skin itch. Your lungs constrict so many things, all the 12 systems. And then the messages of the body send crazy messages back up into the brain because the body is dysregulated. So sometimes people will say to me, oh my God, I heard that my wife died. And my first thought was, oh, but I bought her a birthday present. And then they have all this shame about the fact that their first thought was like unkind or not what they would have wanted it to be. Or someone will say, I got this terrible piece of news and this is how I behaved.
Yep.
I have this funny story. Well, it's not funny. A friend of mine died when I was in my 20s and I wanted to fly to my younger sister to tell her in person. So I got the news in the middle of the night and I got up really early and I was leaving my apartment and my roommate was like, I cannot let you go out in the clothes that you were in. I'm so sorry. And I looked down and I was wearing like shorts and boots and sweater. I mean, I was just dressed insanely. Even though I had intentionally put these clothes together, I was upstairs in my room and was like, these clothes make sense. And I got downstairs and she was like, you're wearing three different seasons worth of clothing. So that kind of inability to go through typical steps just says to us, that's right, your brain has been hit by a frying pan like in one of those cartoons. And partly we think that's adaptive. Your brain is trying not to code every single tiny detail of the most terrible moment of your life because we don't want you to have PTSD. We don't want you to come back to this moment. And so it's almost, even though it feels awful in the moment, it's like this gift of something that your brain is able to do, which is make it all kind of confusing and irregular so that it doesn't necessarily fit back together like a puzzle that you can return to and be in that moment and maybe re-experience the trauma of. So that's one reason why that might happen. But it is incredibly common for the signals and the systems and our thinking to be very, very muddled. The other thing to say is that when the amygdala enlarges and we're in this really reactive, our sympathetic nervous system is sort of driving the bus, and it really just wants to drive us to safety, other parts of our brain shut down. And it's for adaption, right? It's to keep us alive. We're not very curious. We're not super compassionate, which makes sense. If there's a bear in front of you, you don't want your brain being like, I wonder what his fur feels like. You know, you want to be running away from the bear. But what that also means, particularly in grief and loss, is that when you're in that dysregulation, in that sort of hijacked reactive state, some of the processes that are really important, like, do I want this person cremated? How do I want to honor them? What is the legacy that I see? All of that, it's like we need to make some of those decisions before we even have the capacity in the brain to do it.
Yes.
And so what's really important is to be able to say with compassion, I'm going to do the best that I can. And I may have different feelings about this when I move forward.
That's also important because it's true that so many people judge themselves for those early thoughts of the birthday present, or gee, we had a concert next week. Now what are we going to do about the concert? You're not thinking clearly. And I know for me, for a while, I stopped driving as much as I could because I learned early on, you don't really even know how to put the car in park in some moments, as opposed to remembering all the steps of driving, something I had already been doing for a very long time by the time my husband died, but at least had the wherewithal to say, if you don't have to drive right now, let's not do that.
There's so much wisdom in that. Yeah. You know, because if you think about what it's like to be in a reactive state, so just the sympathetic nervous system, it's attending to the pieces that it feels are threatening. And in our world of therapy, we talk about this thing called the window of tolerance, which is this idea that we each have a window that is of a certain size that we function the best when we're inside, sort of smack dab in the middle of the window of tolerance. It's Dan Siegel's concept. But when you are really reactive, that window gets much smaller. And so things impact you in ways that they wouldn't have before. I found I couldn't have the TV on. I couldn't have bright lights on because my body was already working so hard to just try to stay regulated and not in a state of constant distress, that anything that was a little bit too much was liable to tip me back into that state of reactivity, push me out of my window of tolerance, to take me away from being able to do the hard job of grieving. And things that have multi-stepped instructions. I mean, I remember standing in front of, you know, it was like I had to mail a package and it was like I had to pull the tab off and then fold the box and do the, and I was like, no, I have multiple degrees, I'm a grown up and I literally cannot do this.
Yeah.
So I came home and my husband was like, what is that? I was like, it's the box and the postage sticker. I couldn't, you know, and then he just like folded it and put it together. And he was like, I'll give it to the mailman tomorrow. And it sort of, it made me cry a little bit. And it also was like, wow, I am really not in my right mind and my right body.
Right. Absolutely. Let's pause for a second right here while I share some special offers from our sponsors.
Hey, do you have trouble sleeping? Then maybe you should check out the Sleepy Podcast. It's a show where I read old books in the public domain to help you get to sleep. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of classic stories like A Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, Winnie the Pooh. Stories that are great for adults and kids alike. For years now, Sleepy has helped millions of people catch some much-needed Z's, start their next day off fresh, and discover old books that they didn't know they loved. So, whether you have a tough time snoozing or you just like a good bedtime story, fluff up the cool side of your pillow and tune into Sleepy. Unless you're driving, then please don't listen to Sleepy. Find Sleepy on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes each week. Sweet dreams.
Okay, we're back. When it comes to, maybe we can wrap up by talking about the things we should be aware of. So we talked about what to do, what to look for, things to try. But what are some of those habits that we don't want to do while we're grieving? Mm. My example was after my husband died, I was able to tap into short-term disability to get a little time off from work. And then found myself like trying to turn on the ID channel or Dateline. And I'm watching these shows about death over and over and over again. And obviously not a good idea given what I was going through, but that's what I felt like doing. Yeah. But I had to learn, just because you feel like doing that doesn't mean that's a good idea right now. What are some of the things that we should be on the lookout for? I would imagine drinking alcohol. What are the other things that we might reach for that turn out to be a bad idea when we're grieving?
A friend of mine who's an extraordinary counselor, she works in sobriety work, has this question that she asks people that I borrow, which is it hard for you or is it bad for you? And so I use that a lot in my grief and loss work. Is it hard for you or is it bad for you? So it's everything about grief and loss is hard. It's hard to go to a funeral. It's hard to, when we are showing up for our hard, how do we show up? Do we lean on people or do we lean on alcohol? Do we lean on connection or do we lean on disassociation? So it's fine to disassociate. Come home, watch 12 episodes of a, you know, Netflix show. You're not going to hear a word from me. Disassociation is a tool. Dark humor, that may not, your aunt may not like that, but that is wonderful. But if we are only disassociating and we are not attending to, that is not good for you. So again, I don't tell my clients what to do. I just point out what they are doing. So if you're someone who is supporting a griever and you're noticing they are drinking a lot, it is not your job to tell them how to grieve, but it could be loving to say, I understand why you're drinking. Do you feel like that is managing the hard for you, or is it maybe bad for you? And can I help at all? And if they say, shut up, I want to keep drinking, then you just say, I'll shut up for now, but let's keep checking in. So all the dissociative things. And, you know, I sort of jokingly say to my grievers a lot, like, well, it's not meth. You ate half a cake. That's not great, but it's not meth. One thing that I always want to point out to people is most of us have been through some hard things before, and we may have an idea of what it is that we do to get through hard things. So being aware of that, like one thing that will happen for people who have had eating disorders in the past is they may have a renaissance of an eating disorder. One thing that might happen for people who've had depression in the past is they may have a renaissance of depression. Grief is not depression. The symptoms are similar, but they're not the same and they're not treated the same. But you may discover that your grief is driving depression. So I also like to encourage, let's just have an honest conversation about how have you struggled in the past so that we can put up on the pin board, okay, well, let's check for that. We're going to check about food. We're going to check about alcohol. We're going to check about, and so drugs and alcohol are the addictions, but there are also these process addictions. We can pretty much turn anything into a process addiction. You know, gambling is one that's an easy one to think of, but people turn exercise into a process addiction. It's a way of avoiding. So rather than saying, don't do these things, I think I might say to you, I turned production. You know, I wrote 4 books in the time that my mom, you know, since my mom died, which was only 4.5 years ago. People are like, wow, that's really impressive. I'm like, or maybe some dysfunction also, maybe. I liked getting up and writing my books. I didn't encourage myself to go back to sleep, but maybe I should have. So rather than saying do this or don't do that, I might say, are you managing your hard with this? And is it a temporary thing that's okay? Or are you doing something that might be bad for you? And might take a minute to figure that out. It might be, well, I'm just drinking right now, but I'm going to stop. And it might be something that when we look at it in 3 months, oh, nobody stopped. And now we need to really take a look at this. That's always heartbreaking for me as a clinician in grief is like, I don't want you to add something really awful that you have to work through because the actual working through of the thing felt too hard, which again, the mentor method is really designed to sort of help people find something to do to move some of that energy through them that hopefully isn't bad for them.
I like that idea because so often things get either glorified or demonized. Yeah. Somebody who says, I eat the cake or I drink too much, people are like, that's really bad for you. But the person who goes to the gym for 8 hours a day, people are like, rock on, you're doing an amazing job.
Yeah.
And both things could be very harmful for you. They might not be helping you move forward, but it really depends on how are you using those tools, I guess, rather than whether they're good or bad.
I mean, I try to ask people, right? Because one of the things that can be really brutal for a griever who can't eat is because our culture really appreciates and glorifies the idea of smaller bodies. Your husband just died and people are like, wow, you look amazing because you lost 10 pounds. That is really brutal. So instead, when I notice that somebody has lost weight and I know that grief is present, actually sometimes even when I don't know, I will say, you look like you've lost some weight. Is that intentional? Right?
Oh,
so like
that.
I'll
yeah.
comment on it, but I'm not going to assume I know anything about it. Right? Because we want to succeed at grief, and we think succeeding at grief is looking like you're not having an emotional experience. And that doesn't make any sense. That is not what we would actually want. If your husband just died, we want you to have all the emotion. Otherwise, maybe you're a sociopath. Like, maybe it's something much more concerning if you are not truly disrupted. We just don't want you to like bump your bumper car into the wall to the point of destruction. So can we help you by not projecting nonsense on you and asking you tell me about your experience. And then when you are stuck, be able to offer you some pillars, which, you know, there's yoga comes up a lot. People say yoga is really good for grievers. It is, except for the people who absolutely will have a panic attack if you ask them to sit still. It's right. Really not good for those people. And that's kind of true about everything. That whatever I say to you, Amy, this is really good for you, it's also really not good for some people. So instead, what we say is, here's a bunch of stuff. You tell me what's good for you. You tell me whether this registers as right for you.
So then maybe that's going to be my last question. If somebody listening says, gosh, my best friend is going through a loss, my sister just lost an in-law, how do I support somebody else who's grieving? What do you say or what do you do for those people?
Well, first of all, bless you for caring and for asking that question. And I think we owe you as a supporter as much as we owe the griever. So again, the mentor method and that and its sort of ilk is designed for everybody. It's designed for everybody to understand. But at its core, understand that you are on the sidelines while this person is running the marathon. And that your job is to figure out how to hand them Gatorade gummies and cups of water and tell them that you know they can do it. There is no room for you saying, boy, she should really be picking her knees up more. Or wow, she's running slower than I expected. There is no room for any of what you think they should be doing, because what you think they should be doing are just thoughts that you have. And you know what? The griever themselves might have thought they should have been doing those things too. And so what I say to grievers is, if you cannot embody that energy, step back, because you will hinder your person's progress. They will feel less connected and they will feel shame and they will feel your judgment. But what I really encourage supporters to do is believe that they can do this and listen, ask all the time, how is today? Not how are you doing, but how is today? How have the last 3 hours been? What was yesterday like? Just tell me about your experience. And then the phrase that I use the most is, I believe you. God, I believe that. I try not to say I understand, because that can be harmful, but I probably do say I understand a lot. I believe you. That makes sense to me. God, I believe you. God, that makes sense to me. That really makes sense to me. And then, you know, again, with the grief mentor method, if you are someone who is trying to support a griever, what you get is those six pillars, and you get to say, hey, have you been outside for a walk today? Because you know that that's good for them. Do you want me to come over and take a walk with you? Because you know that sometimes doing something in connection with another person makes it easier. And that isolation is something we're really trying to encourage grievers to not kind of crystallize into a ball in a closet somewhere and allow them to still be part of the functioning world. So as much as we can say, I see you, you can show up however you are. And I swear you, it all makes sense to me.
Yeah.
How you feel, I can handle that. So many people, because I'm a therapist, they're like, I don't want you to think I'm about to kill myself. And I'm like, I actually don't think that you're about to kill yourself, but I think it's fine if you need to tell me that you kind of want to, or that you, that feels simpler than, because there's so much reactivity about people just telling the truth about how they feel. And my assumption is how they feel is freaking awful. And I want them to have a chance to say that. And if they can say that to me, it's a huge honor.
That's so powerful, just to give people space and whatever they feel is okay. Because I think sometimes people do feel that pressure to say like, oh, you shouldn't feel like that. Or let's go bowling, even though you don't feel like going out, because we want to cheer you up.
Yeah.
And we don't know what to say. And I know I've been there. Even
me
as a
therapist. Me too.
And I get to those places where I'm like, you know, I just don't have the words for somebody in my personal life. They go through a loss and I say, I'm sorry, doesn't really feel like it cuts it. But sometimes I just don't have the words. So I've learned to just say that, like, I don't always have the right words to say. And people are like really forgiving of that. Like, I get it. Thank you for just being here and acknowledging. And so I like that question of just saying, how was today, instead of the typical, hey, how are you doing? Or how have things been going? People feel pressure to say great. But if you say, how is today? I think that takes a lot of the pressure off.
Yeah. And I think also when you are, especially when you're in the inner circle, you know, you may even have your own, like if your best friend's husband dies, you probably have your own grief about this. So just remember, it's like a fire brigade. If you're going to show up for your friend, you need somebody to show up for you. Because you're, what you would normally do is say to your friend, like, I'm having a hard time. And when you can't do that with a primary griever, they have to have the whole center of the bullseye for themselves. It's not forever, but it is for now. So just remember that, like, just because you're a supporter doesn't mean that you don't also need support. That, and I've seen people do that in really beautiful ways. When I was really sick, I got into a huge fight with my best friend, who's been my best friend since I was 11. And she, I wouldn't let her talk to me. I was furious. And so she and my husband talked to each other. I sort of could see it in my periphery vision and I couldn't care about it. But later when I was better, I was like, oh God, that was so good for both of them, because my husband was really concerned about me and my best friend was really concerned about me. And normally they would have taken those concerns to me, but they couldn't. So keeping that in mind, that like, if you're the support system, that doesn't mean you have to be like the hero who has no feelings. There's going to be a lot of feelings everywhere. You just want to have a line of people behind you as well, who are checking in with you and sending you texts saying, thinking about you today, or I saw this article, or I'm wondering how your friend is, or I just want you to know I said a prayer for you. All that stuff goes a really long way. Because what happens when you're grieving is a little bit feels like you're in a crowd of people and you have burnt to the ground, like was struck by lightning, and everybody just keeps moving around like it didn't happen. And so it can turn into this like lonely, isolated place really quickly. And instead, in order to still be a part of the world, we have to say like, yes, we can see that you are singed over every square inch of your body. We can see that. And we're so sorry, and you didn't deserve it. And also, if you need to stand still, that's okay. And if you want to take a couple of steps, that's okay. We're here. And the we're is maybe me, and then the people who are supporting me, and then the people who are supporting them, and it becomes a big net.
Such wise advice. Megan, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm going to link to your podcast because I hope anybody who's struggling with grief goes and listens to it, and that they check out your book, End of the Hour.
Amy, thank you so much. It's such an honor to call you a friend and to have had two hours with you. It's just my really great luck. I love the work that you're doing and I really appreciate being here.
Thank you. I had no idea that talking about grief could be fun, right?
I know. I laugh about it all the time. It's a part of life and it's really hard, but it's also part of our humanity, which means it's silly and ridiculous and funny also.
It certainly is. Thank you for all that you do, Megan.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Welcome to The Therapist Take. It's the part of the show where I'll break down some of my favorite strategies that Megan shared. I loved her mentor method because it gives actionable tips on what to do. And just having some ideas about that can be so helpful when you are feeling completely heartbroken. So let's run through those things again. The M in mentor is for mindfulness. When you're grieving, it's sometimes too painful to think about the past and too hard to think about the future. So it's helpful to just pay attention to what's going on right this very second. It might be something as simple as just looking around the room and noticing what's happening, or scanning your body and noticing what you feel, like my foot feels uncomfortable in this position, or my back aches a little bit. The E in mentor is for energy. Like Megan said, sometimes people have energy and don't know what to do with it. So they're pacing or they're cleaning the garage at 2 a.m. And other people feel like they don't have the energy to get out of bed. It's important to pay attention to your energy levels, how they shift, and to notice what energizes you. The N in mentor is for nourishment. not only is food important, but you need to think about what else nourishes your mind, your body, and your soul. That could include anything from music and being around friends to going for walks and listening to podcasts. The T in mentor is for translating. The emotional roller coaster that comes along with grief affects the story that you tell yourself. For example, guilt is a really common feeling, and you might start to think, oh, I should have done something different. I should have convinced my loved one to see a doctor sooner, or I should have known something was wrong. And then your story becomes that you're a bad person or that you're a victim. Translating involves doing the work to create a more realistic and a healthier story. You might learn to recognize that you aren't a victim of a tragic circumstance, but instead, you're a superhero who survived tough times. And the O in mentor is for outside. Just getting outside can do wonders for your emotional health. And I also like the idea of getting outside your network because your friends and family might also be grieving. They might feel uncomfortable around you, or they might not know what to say or what to do, so they avoid you. After I lost my mother and my husband, I can remember how refreshing it felt to sometimes meet people who didn't know me before. Like, they didn't know the old me, and they weren't going to assess how I was grieving or how I was doing or how much I had changed. So think about that. It might involve joining a support group, trying something new, or visiting new places to help your healing process. And the R in mentor is about ritual. Establishing rituals can really help you honor your loved one while also figuring out, how am I going to live in a world without them here? Megan mentioned finding ways to honor the difficult dates, like a birthday or an anniversary. And that was something that I talked about in my book, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. When my husband Lincoln died, his family and I decided to honor his birthday by going on an adventure every year together. The first year we went skydiving. We've done other things too, like we took flying trapeze lessons and we swam with sharks and we rode mules into the Grand Canyon. It's been 18 years since he died, but we still try to get together to do something on his birthday every year. And it's been one of the most helpful things that I've done to work through my grief. So that's Megan's mentor method for dealing with grief. If you want to read more about her story, check out her book, End of the Hour, or listen to her podcast, Grief is My Side Hustle. Thank you for hanging out with me today and for listening to the Mentally Stronger podcast. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. That's one of the best ways to help us get our show in front of other people so we can make the world a stronger place. And if you want more tips on building mental strength, subscribe to Mentally Stronger Premium. Every week, I answer questions from the Mentally Stronger audience, and I create a special bonus episode. Every member also gets really cool monthly gifts, like a mental strength cheat sheet or signed copies of my book in the mail. Sign up at mentallystronger.supercast.com or just click on the link in the show notes. If you know somebody who could benefit from learning more about mental strength, share this show with them. Simply sharing a link to this episode could help somebody feel better and grow stronger. And as always, a big thank you to my show's producer, who lets me pretend to be his Uber driver so I can drop him off at his celebrity friends' houses just so I can see what their house looks like from the outside, Nick Valentine.